because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game. I had great experiences speaking at the Omaha, Massachusetts, and Minnesota Coaching Association clinics over the last few weeks. I wanted to share what one attendee and current member of Basketball Immersion said. They told me, being a member of Basketball Immersion has unlocked a new and efficient way of coaching that I didn't know existed prior to joining. Being able to then see you present in person helped bring your philosophy into reality for me and my program. I was impressed by your willingness to take time to not only demonstrate, but also to ensure that the people understood the technical and tactical aspects of what you shared and the reasons why it works. I am grateful for the support of so many of you with this podcast and the membership website. As your season starts, I'd love to have you join basketballimmersion.com. Go to basketballimmersion.com/sign-up to join today. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. Today, I am really excited to have someone who's had great success in coaching and it has been a tremendous mentor to so many people that I know personally. And Jimmy Tillett is here, and former head coach at Samford University, where he had great success, is still the winningest coach all time there, and now is a high school coach at Isidore. Coach, what is it? Isidore Newman High School, right?
In New Orleans. Isidore Newman, where the Mannings went and when Odell Beckham went.
Awesome. We will not get into those two stories because that would be fun too. But
well, we can talk about Michael Lewis. He went there too, you know, so we get to cover both worlds, the academic and the athletic.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for spending some time with us, and welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris. I appreciate it.
Coach, going back to so much of your success, you're a Princeton guy in terms of running a lot of Princeton offense and different things like that. But let's start with your evolution as a coach. What has changed for you in these years moving forward from even college to high school now? What things have changed for you?
Well, let me go back and begin, if it's okay, where when I first started coaching in high school for 15 years and then into college, I was a proponent of motion offense. And so we ran five-man motion in high school. When I went to Mississippi State, I was the offensive coordinator, putting that in, spent time at Tulane. And then when I was at Samford, John Brady was in charge of the defense, and I was pretty much the OC, and we were still running five-man motion. And so in my mind, looking at that and then trying to look at what I thought would be another stage in evolution, looking at the Princeton, I came up with this idea about offense. That the best offense, all things being equal, you don't necessarily have the best talent. You know, you don't have overwhelmingly the best talent, or you have no chance because you're so far down in the athletic food chain, is that you want an offense that's going to combine narrow vision with wide action. And when we ran motion, we had a lot of wide action. But the problem was the ball often had to look at simultaneous action and missed a lot of opportunities to be able to exploit defensive mistakes. And so that we had wide action, but we had wide vision. So when I looked at the Princeton concepts, they had wide action, but the ball, and this is one of the secrets of it, the ball is always looking at the defensive mistake because you're looking at things sequentially, not simultaneously. And you can then penalize the defense for that. So we adopted that system and we had success with that. Now, I didn't evolve quick enough as teams after a couple of years began to guard us in a way, not that they knew what the forthcoming concepts were because it's nuanced and it's complicated, but they just simply got into us and took us off our dribble angles and passing angles. And so I then, getting back into high school and putting some thought into this, I tried to combine, which would be on the surface, two antagonistic systems, the dribble drive system with the Princeton system, and identified two aspects that were initially troubling, like what do you do with the guy in the corner when you're driving it really to his side of the lane? And what do you do up at the top when you have guard-to-guard action or X-to-X action or something of this nature? And so I resolved that, and I sort of put the spots to where they were identical. And we've had really good success, relative success. We're going just east and west with the Princeton and then north and south with the dribble drive. And so had I been smarter, we might have had more success down the road years ago in college with this, because I think now that's the way to go. You have to be able to change from north and south to east and west as much as you possibly can within an offensive structure.
We'll get into that a little bit. Do you think part of it is that the Princeton was really overexposed? I know it's still difficult to defend, but part of it is familiarity, right? People got used to seeing it. It wasn't like such a unique thing that this one game was completely different than others. Is that fair to say that Princeton became more common?
Yeah, I think so. And that allowed defenses to catch up. I know that I can't imagine having to play Princeton years ago and having no video and having no shot clock, anything of that nature. And they never talked about their offense. And so when Coach Carmody became the head coach, succeeding Coach Carrill, who never talked about it in understanding why, I had done some homework. I had worked this spring before I was named head coach, as I did every spring trying to break down offense. I took literally 99 pages of notes and I put it onto 21 transparencies and called Coach Carmody and Joe Scott, who I knew, and said, hey, I'd like to come up. And I went up there like a geek bearing gifts, the idea that I had actually worked on the offense. Here it is, let me show you. And we didn't exchange terminology, but we did exchange ideas. And so I never really liked to talk about that very much, but I think with the advent of just this universal video and things of this nature and more people running it because of certain successes, I think that's fair to say, and for sure. And that's why Joe Scott changed a lot of what he was doing when he was at the Air Force in Denver, and guys who were steeped in the Princeton system. I can't think of the guy's name. I'm having a senior moment. Ed Richmond now. Anyway.
Mooney.
Yeah, Chris Mooney. Chris Mooney. Those guys have gone away and changed it on their own, as did Carmody when he became the head coach. He changed things too. So, yeah, so I think the interesting thing about that is you can retain the essence of the offense even though you change some outward components. So it's a whole idea of being deceptive, because what you're doing and while your team is developing good judgment, the ability to discern the similarity in different things and the difference in similar things, the defense really is behind the eight ball, because things are going to look alike and they're not. Things are going to look very similar and they're not. So, yeah, but I think in general, I think your analysis is correct. And also playing against more athletic teams who are just going to get into you. And even if they don't understand the concept, their athleticism is going to trump yours.
Well, it's fascinating, and it's like a lot of those offenses, like the triangle, obviously this, and high post offense, different things like that. They've all evolved, and people have taken pieces of them and adapted them. And I think from watching Bill Carmody's stuff, like he put in more isolation and more type of dribble drives type of stuff for players, but more in type isolation and matchup. When you added dribble drive, is it matchup oriented, or is it more freedom of decision for players to be able to break off action to be able to drive?
No, it's completely free. In fact, to the point, I've just retired this year, really because of some physical ailments. I had one knee replaced and getting another one, but I haven't retired from the mental aspects of coaching, and I may work again anyway. But what my belief now is similar to Doug Novak, who I know you know, is the idea is I want an explanation, you know, why the action is slowed down. We want to play as fast as we can in offense. And what I mean necessarily shoot, I've always believed that it's not the quickness of the players, it's the speed of the offense. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to play as fast as we can with certainty and then make good decisions from that with judgment. And you have some built in, and it's easier in high school because you don't have a clock, you know, which is pounding at you, to be able to play with safety and be able to take care of the ball. So those two can go together, the speed of the offense and the safety and security of the offense.
So we still want a high percentage shot. We don't want a quick shot. We want a high percentage shot. And within the Princeton offense, what defines that now? Do we go with modern analytics in terms of rim and three? Because Pete Carrill was kind of ahead of the time. I mean, when I saw them practice, all they did is shoot threes. That was a philosophy.
Yeah, I think that's still true. I mean, from a defensive standpoint, wouldn't you like to force everyone to take long twos? So, yeah, obviously we want balls into the lane. We want to be able to – so get the ball into the lane, either with a back cut or with some form of effective dribble. Now, what we've done to extend that, or you know, picking up on some of the ideas of my friends, is we now are dribbling to posts. So we're taking guards. We're giving everybody an opportunity. We're providing instruments for everyone who is handling the ball to get into the post and working on post moves and isolating there. So that's a little bit different. But, yeah, we're also going to shoot threes. Now, it's going to be interesting to me to see this year what that means when they move the line back. And I really think you're at the end really of cerebral play in college. Anything below 30 seconds is going to turn into the NBA. And those coaches who are at the best schools athletically wanted to do that anyway. I used to go to the Division I meeting and vote against that every year, you know, reducing the clock. But yeah, so yeah, that's what you want for effective offense. You want opportunities to score around the basket, and you're teaching kids, again, instruments. You're giving them some options of how to do it. And then you want to shoot open threes. You love to shoot stationary threes. Those are the best threes.
Well, no question. No question. And that was one of the values of, as you said, adding dribble drive, is that leads to, you know, more kick out, standstill threes potentially. So that's part of it. But let's go backwards, coach. Let's talk about the essence of the Princeton backdoor cuts. What are the reads and the rules for backdoor cuts that you emphasize to your players?
Okay, so essentially, if we know that we're in a situation that is what we're calling for a backdoor opportunity. So if I've got the basketball, and this is what defenders would try and do into the later years of this, is they would crowd your space and take you off your dribble angle. Because if I'm dribbling at you, a teammate, I really want to dribble below you. And even if your defender's up contesting the pass, but I want to dribble below you. And we really got to where we find this pretty good from the top of the key, say, over to, say, the left wing. I really want to dribble at what we call the V, which is where the corner is, where it intersects. So that's the first part. That's where I've got to get to. And we used to talk about fighting for a dribble angle. So I have to be tough enough with the ball and create some space only to be able to put the ball on the floor with the proper angle. Secondly, the difference between dribbling and driving is when you're driving, you want to be as vertical. When I say vertical, I don't mean height. I mean long steps as you possibly can. But in throwing a backdoor pass, what you want to do is you want your steps sort of chopped. So you're sort of shuffling your feet more so. The third thing is your hand goes from on top to on side. We call pound push. Or you're pounding the ball and then your hand just turns sideways and you're pushing the ball through. And then the fourth thing of that is that you just walk through your pass. So if wherever I'm going, whichever angle I'm on, whichever path I'm on, and I throw the backdoor pass, okay, and I just continue to walk in that straight line. You don't pull off the pass. You don't pull your hand back. That lets the defense know you're getting ready to throw that. So I'm looking at space. I'm looking at just anything behind the person I'm throwing to. I don't worry about him beating his defender because cutting's a race, and we know we're going to win the race because we know when the race starts. So when I bounce the ball, when the ball hits the floor, not as I'm getting ready to dribble it, but coming up from the floor, that's going to signal his cut, and I'm just going to throw the ball to space. Any space, I'm going to throw it, and he's going to run and go get it. And oftentimes, you've got to then finish on the other side of the basket because of where you are relative to your feet. But the last part of the feet is there's not a correct foot to shoot with. You're trying to get the ball up to the goal as quickly as you can, whether it be in front of the rim, which is more of a broad jump, or around the rim, which is a high jump. But either way, you got to get the ball up there quickly because athletes will erase their mistakes. Someone will come out of nowhere and try and block a shot.
Well, and again, that gets misconstrued about the Princeton, that it's just really, you know, really organized, structured offense, but everything's based on reads and cues and the different things that come with it. But in a way, it was also what some people might argue was less fundamental, because we're not doing two-hand passes all the time. We're passing off the dribble and we're finishing, as you just said. There's no perfect finish. It's perfect. It's how do you just finish, right, in terms of those things.
And I really think it's interesting when people say it's not fundamental. And what that means is typically that it's not traditional in the way that they learn something.
That's what I mean. But, not traditional fundamentals.
Yes. But it's definitely fundamentals. It's like when we teach your kids to score in the post. We're teaching them to score off 1 foot, all right, when you have space. But if you don't have space, you can make space with it with a two-foot move, what is called a stride stop. You can use your butt to create space. And so what we're doing there is, and we're teaching kids also to finish off of different feet. So all we're doing is redirecting your balance. And when we're throwing balls with one hand, we don't want to put a second hand on the ball. So all we're doing is we're just being able to work on snapping through. So these are fundamentals to what we do. It's just not the ordinary conventional fundamentals. If we had more talent than the team we're playing, and often you don't, that's Princeton teams, why they run this, is then you have to be able to get the ball in and out of your hands as quickly as you can with balance. You want to begin on balance and end on balance. And so it's about that. It's about being accurate, being meticulous, snapping the ball through and reading defenses, making good judgments.
So it's the efficiency of the offense that's always attracted me. And I've started to define skill a little bit for people in terms of thinking about skill in terms of the elimination of something. And for me, when I watch Princeton offense, I look at the elimination of something. Like, there's just an efficiency, as you said, about the dribble, about the cut, about the sprint to space, all these different things. And I don't know, did you spend time with Coach Kirill in terms of this? You said he wasn't really that open about sharing, but did you get a chance to?
No, he never shared. You know, the funny story about Coach Kirill is I've been in that old Princeton offense, you know, and they had a student worker who was temporary secretary, and she might then go off to class. And they would tell stories about these guys would be in there and the phone would ring, and they would kind of hope that Coach would answer it. And they could understand what he was saying. He'd be on the line and, oh, you want to talk offense? Oh, and Coach, after a couple of minutes, would say, well, let me ask you, how much golf do you play? And I guess the person would think, well, gee, Coach wants to play golf with me. And what's going to happen pretty quickly is Coach is going to say, you know what? You play too much golf. Why don't you do what I did, is figure it out for yourself and then hang the phone up and stuff like that. So, no, he was a crusty guy. He wasn't talking at all. In fact, the year before, when we spent time with them, we were in a tournament at Iowa State. Tim Floyd was coaching there. We all stayed at the same hotel. And we'd have a drink. We'd be sitting down talking, you know, in this tournament. And he'd be talking about a lot of stuff. And you'd bring something up for offense. And he'd change the subject. And he was not going to get pulled into that conversation.
It's amazing. And obviously so much influence on the game, considering how little, obviously, you're saying he shared. So truly amazing. But is it fair to characterize parts of the Princeton offense as what I said in terms of, like, it eliminates certain things to increase the efficiency?
Yeah, but it's sort of a misnomer, like I said before, that it looks like you're doing a lot of things, but you know, it's like playing the Dallas Cowboys years ago when they had really five plays, but they had 25 formations. So it looks like it's complex, but it's really not that complex. I mean, once you learn the deception and once you learn the sets that are pretty much all going to end the same way, they're just going to end from a different angle. Then, you know, then it becomes simplicity, or really on the far side of complexity. I mean, you've got some things that look complex, but they're really not. And so, yeah, you're eliminating things, but certain things like what we would call a drift screen. If I dribbled at a person through a back cut, and simultaneously the person below him from the corner would fill up. So if I can't hit the back cut, then my secondary option is to throw to the fill-up guy, and here comes the post player, and he's going to set a screen on that defender who has been taught to jump to the ball. So now I pass it to the wing. My defender jumps toward the wing pass, and then the post comes and screens him, and I move away from the defender, shuffling my feet. So the defender then is in a quandary. How do they play that? He's been taught to jump to the ball. So really what you're doing, it's like Aikido. You're taking advantage of the defensive mistakes and what they've been taught to do.
Right. You're taking advantage of what is actually good defense, which is the tendency
that's exactly
of the defense.
Right. Yeah, no, it's great stuff, brilliant stuff.
It's like years ago, I remember watching, this is how old I am, watching Providence play around the same time, Jimmy Walker and Pete Maravich. The defenses were so good at guarding the ball and getting a trail hand in between the guy who's dribbling the ball and their stance. And so this pretty much effectively eliminated crossover dribbling. So this led to the advent of dribbling between the legs, because that was safe as cross, and then now people were able to speed that up. And I'm sure that was viewed as, oh, that's just, you know, decoration. No, I mean, it was used for a purpose. But originally that was just thought of, well, that, you know, these are people just, you know, it's non-traditional, it's non-fundamental. And so it's merely ornamental, and that's not true. So there's you study the game, there's a reason why things develop and why things stay in the game and why things change.
I have a fascination with the way the Princeton offense was traditionally taught. I'm not sure how you teach it, but the Princeton coaches that I've seen do an immense amount of 5-on-0. And yet the offense is based on decisions and cues, which require defense to make those decisions. And I've always been fascinated by that dichotomy that exists with teaching it and then the application of it. But then the other part that goes with that, and you can answer this, traditional Princeton coaches that I've seen do a lot of 5-on-5, where they counter that with obviously doing a ton of 5-on-5, and it's not just all breakdown drills. Is there ways that you found best to teach basketball, but especially focused on the offensive stuff you do?
Well, to teach the 5-on-0, obviously, there's advantages to that and disadvantages. The disadvantage, you know, there's no pressure on your dribble angle. There's no pressure on your passing angle and things of this nature. The advantage is what you're teaching yourself is you're teaching yourself the speed of the offense and what is known, I called it ABC, the action beyond the concept. So I'm dribbling to make a play. Nothing eventuates. Where do I go next? I call it the sub act. What's the sub act? Well, what comes next? So all it is a series of concepts which follow one another based upon what I do with the ball. If I can't throw the ball for, say, a back cut pass, do I make a pass here? Do I dribble the ball out to like a guard-to-guard, which signals something else, and that brings up whenever the ball is at one guard to guard, you need a twin and someone on the other one. And that can get into like a chin concept that everybody's familiar with. You know, you throw a guard to guard and get a back screen by the post player. So that's good for the 5-0. Now what you got to do is you got to put defense out there, and you got to get some days where defenses are going to be instructed to hold the offenders. Maybe they've got to make fists or something of the nature, but they can hold them with their forearms and things like this to get people to move through the resistance, which if you're interested in Clausewitz, let me expound on that fog and friction later on. And so, then you got to be able to make judgments. So sometimes we put the defense at a disadvantage where we're driving the basketball and we're orchestrating who helps. The offense doesn't know who helps. We told the defense how to help. And then you got to make good judgments out of that. So I think all three of those things have to be right, particularly nowadays, as there is still some understanding of the Princeton, but it's interesting because it's making a comeback. And it's particularly making a comeback with the trend of now combining it with the dribble drive. And so there's a lot, what I see, particularly in high school, but in some colleges also, I see where people are very intrigued with trying to combine the two.
Well, and we're going to get into that because I'm excited to hear about that. And, you know, I mean,
the chin action exists as its own play. The cut and replace that you talked about exists a lot, especially in the NBA with the 45 cut to the basket to take advantage of a defender that loses sight on off the ball. So there's parts of the Princeton that have, again, they hold true no matter what offense you run. Are there some other parts of it that you think are should be more used by coaches as those standalone actions or those automatics, as they call them nowadays?
No, and that's the beauty of it, is you can change it from year to year based upon your personnel and still retain the essence of it, but just change where the point of attack might be for a certain player or whose hands you want the ball in for most of the time or something of this nature. And also, there's something related to the chin, which I mentioned, which you're familiar with. What's kind of going away from that, because I think some people have studied it, but I don't think they've studied it in its entirety and in its depth. That was originally designed for when that post player sets that back screen, and he's presumably, with a good back screen and a good cut, he's going to create help with his defender. If his defender doesn't help, well, then the cutter should be open. So typically, back screener now would just simply run. Go take a beeline to where the ball is on the wing and try and catch right after the back screen. That was the secondary action. The tertiary action then would be if you ran and there was a defender there, that meant that you now were screening the person who was above you who made that pass to the wing. So does this make sense to you, what I'm saying?
Absolutely. No, it's the depth of the teaching and the understanding of all that, yes.
You got to spend some time on the teaching. There's no question. You have to, of course, create a vocabulary, a language, so where we can communicate with one another, which is our own, which is idiosyncratic, which we understand what that means and nobody else understands what that means.
Well, and that's the beauty of a team, right? And that's the beauty of the language that you use. And you talked about it. I believe you said, is it fog and friction or fog and fiction?
No, it's fog and friction. So yes. I teach a couple of different classes, well, one of which I've taught this for years. I taught it in high schools years ago and very interested in military history. And at Newman, I teach a class called American Conflicts, which is the wars of America. And so we talk about, as a preliminary aspect, individual wars, principles, LES and ALS. So individuals throughout history, and then principles of warfare. So one of the guys who was a major interpreter of Napoleon after the Napoleonic Wars in the 19th century, he was a Prussian. His name was Karl von Clausewitz. He's still relevant, and he still taught it. Academies, as is Anton Jomini, who was a Swiss Frenchman, he still taught. They have very divergent ideas about interpretations of Napoleon. One of the things I like about Clausewitz, which I think is relevant for athletics, is his notion is battle equals stress. Obviously, these are men at war, their lives are in jeopardy. So when you're engaged in battle, when you're engaged in this highly stressful situation, there are two elements that are going to pervade the battlefield. The first one is called, there's going to be a fog which is going to descend. For him, the fog means communication. Typically what happens under stress, there is an immediate degrading of communication. So people are confused, they didn't hear things right, they're not sure what happens, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to fight against the fog. You have to find ways to be able to effectively communicate, make sure your players understand this. The second part is the friction, which means that, and this goes to complication. This means that the simplest thing without battle, without stress, can be accomplished. But once you add stress something, the simplest things can become difficult. The defense is going to grab. They're going to be in a different place, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you've got to fight through the friction. You fight against the fog, the degrading of communication, and you fight through the friction. I think independent of basically any sport you're in, you know, any concept of offensive football, defense, whatever it is. So I think those are two really good elements that I talked to our team about a lot, about what we're doing here and what's going to happen when we encounter some form of resistance in playing a game, and the stress is obviously going to accompany that.
Coach, it's by far the first time Napoleon's ever been referenced on this podcast, so you'll live on forever. That's awesome. How do you work on creating better passers? Because that was always a component of this. So what's the best methodology to do that?
Well, are you talking playing in space or playing in tight?
Well, let's just say general as a decision maker to pass, and then the type of decision to execute. So it could be both in that sense.
Yeah, okay. Well, just as a general rule, you know, if you ever watched Princeton years ago, warm up before the game, they would have something called star passing, which you'd pass and go replace, and it would wind up the ball would be moved five times, and it would resemble a star. But they typically snap the ball from within their shoulders because they were typically playing in space. So if you're playing in space, then they would stay back from the line, away from the line. It's like, why don't they move up to the line because they can now be in a position to shoot. Well, you'll eventually do that, but what you want to do playing in space, you can now snap the ball with two hands between your shoulders, and you can play with the ball in the center of your body. You're playing in tight, the ball has to be shifted to one side or the other away from the defender. So that's an entirely different pass. The ball, you're going to have two hands on the ball, but there's going to be a quick snap and extension from your hand furthest away from the defender. So you work on the techniques of those things, all right, and you use your feet. We're big on a pivoting for it's not a digression, it's parenthetical to what we're talking about, because pivoting can help you extricate yourself to create space to make passes. And so this is part of a John Beilein thing. When I went there, I have a place in Ann Arbor. The year I was out of coaching after Sanford, I was doing consulting. But John was very nice, and I went to his practices a lot. And they had the little aspect what they worked on, that which they call breakfast passing, which was donuts and waffles. Well, since I've added donuts, waffles, pancakes, and bagels. And so that sounds, you know, esoteric, but what it is, that you're just teaching your different pivots to be able to pass away from pressure, okay, and also be able to extricate yourself from pressure. So this is a huge component, an undervalued component of passing, is your pivoting to be able to get open. And then the other part of that would be the notion of judgment. So, yeah, it's all about judgment. Do you have space? Who's being guarded you? One of the things we talk about in the dribble drive and also with the Princeton when you're driving the basketball is you got to get your hand on top of the ball to be able to pound the ball, get it hard to the ground and as quickly as you can back into your hand, because that's when you have control. And you need to get your eyes up on the rim, A, to be able to finish, and B, to see where the health comes from, to know who's open. And then you have to be able to deliver the ball, make the right decision. You know, who is open at that point? So the ball always has the opportunity. I'm picking up on this. The ball always has the opportunity in terms of teaching kids to see and share. The ball always has the first opportunity to score. So if I passed it to you, it would be you first for us. We call that me first for us. Doug does the same thing with that. So you now have that opportunity. But at some point in time, when you get the basketball, it might not be the best opportunity. So selling our kids on this, we would say, listen, I'm not asking you to surrender the me for the we. What I'm asking you to do, I'm asking you to select the best from the rest. So let's say you catch it and you're not open to score. You recognize that immediately. There's someone below you or above you that's wide open. The ball should immediately go out of your hands because that's the best option and opportunity for us to score. So you're planning the brains of your kids when you're working on judgment. I know you have the first opportunity because the ball is in your hands, but it may not be the best opportunity. So it's a gradual, you know, it's like a slinky effect, going back and forth with teaching them how to finish, how to score, and then from there, seeing who's open, what's our best opportunity to be able to penalize the defense. That's nothing that's inculcated or cultivated overnight. That's something that has to be talked about from day one and through the last game.
Awesome. Yeah, great explanation, great detail to that. And obviously the spacing and all the different components that come into that that make all those decisions more effective are a brilliant part of the offense too. So, Coach, let's dig into
I just want to pick on something in which it's like I work with kids all the time with teams, and I tell kids, like, we're just starting. I say, okay, four of you guys, each get a basketball. and space proportionally on the baseline. And it's like, what? What do you say? And then you look up and you got, I'm at sort of at midcourt facing them. And I see player A is kind of where he is, and player B is 2 steps away, and player C is 8 steps away, and player D is 9 steps away. And right there, you see the kids don't understand about proportional spacing. So it's imperative to anything you're doing in either one of these offenses to stretch the defense that you be exactly where you're supposed to be when you're supposed to be there. This is called Aristotle's hitting the mean, right? The right amount in the right proportion at the right time, okay, at the right place. So you can't just run around and not be spaced properly. And if you're moving, you're trying to get somewhere. You're trying to create space quickly and get somewhere because, as we said before, you shoot the ball better when you catch and shoot rather than off the move. So get yourself in a position to go from stationary to sprint to stationary. So this is another undercoached part of that Princeton stuff is you're not being just geometric to be geometric, but there's a reason why, and we also mark the floor about where kids should be optimally spaced, and I leave that down for the whole, really for the whole year for kids. And the defense has no idea what that necessarily means. So I didn't mean to pick up on that, but that's such a huge part of being able to score. And that was another problem in motion because of screening. As people come together with screening and cutting, then they it's difficult to teach them to re-space proportionally to where both of you then can be threats to the defense. Usually somebody's not moving the way that they should because there's a lot of movement, a lot of reading there. I didn't mean to step on your toes.
No, please, Coach. This is awesome stuff, and I love just the phrasing and the terminology and the thoughtfulness that goes into so many things.
I'm a big phrase terminology guy. I spend a lot of time on this because I think that, you know, anything that is poorly said is rarely wisely heard. So I'm always trying to find what I call felicitous phrasing. So in years of basketball, you want to learn how to say something with concision and clarity. And really, you want people not to be able to understand, but the opposite. You want them to not misunderstand. So that's the key to that. And, you know, like I teach this one class in military history, and I've developed some felicitous phrasing because of the years. I'm teaching a second class this year, the first foray into this, and it seemed like a good idea at the time, but it's a bear. I'm teaching a history of Western philosophy. So I'm trying to learn felicitous phrasing that goes into my brain and out of my mouth so these kids can understand things. So again, it's incumbent upon the coach to say things in a way that not only can be understood, but can't be misunderstood. And that's a huge difference, but that's an important difference.
It's something that's been very clear on this podcast and talking to so many successful coaches is just how much I noticed the importance of phrasing and the efficiency of language. And as you said, different communications that you've used already. So it's an outstanding point. And Coach, I know we can't leave here without diving into this metamorphosis of the Princeton office and blending with the dribble drive. Can you talk about what that means? Because I know you're going to get a ton of questions about this. Can you give some details on what that means?
Well, I think it creates just more options for us in terms of facing the floor, but also being able to penalize defenders for getting into us. So we've gotten so much better at kids working what we call body up, body by. When I have the ball and my defender bodies up to me, we work really hard at getting by that defender and being able to be effective and efficient. Now we're back to the verticality of our steps. So our first step is a little shorter step. Our second step is a long step because we're trying to accelerate. If you reverse the two with a long step and your second step for balance is going to be shorter, you're actually decelerating, not accelerating. And so we really worked on that with various types of finishes with either hand, an inside finish or an outside finish off of 1 foot and 2 feet. And so that has really been crucial for us. And you get fouled more, that aspect. And then having a safety mechanism for some kid who's trying to drive the ball and they can't get through what I call the driveway, wherever that is. And then we say you got to bounce the ball. So you want to bounce it out to a certain area. Usually it's guard-to-guard area, but you can bounce it back to a wing. And it's an optimistic way to coach kids because what you tell them when they do that is that's great judgment, A. And B, don't worry about it that you can't get through the driveway and you throw in the magic word, yet. You can't get through there yet. And so you don't need to try if you can't right now. It's okay because we're going to get better at this. So don't worry about the fact that you can't get through it yet. Yeah, we just want to take care of the ball and safely extricate ourselves and move on in offense. Let's get there as quickly as we can. So these are some mechanisms, I think, in terms of teaching kids that they feel comfortable in the learning stages. And I think, you know, the whole notion of improvement, I have people who talked about the notion of what comes first, confidence or success. And I would say, well, the thing that comes first really is improvement. Focus on improvement. Robert Frost, I don't know if you probably get a lot of reference for him. He says that the fact is the sweetest dream that labor knows. The idea that you're doing something and you're actually able to accomplish something, it does wonders for you. So you self-improved. So now you go to the second part. So you feel good about that. The second part then is you know how far you can improve. That gives you a sense of seriousness and purpose. And the third thing is it gives you optimism because you are improving. And so that's going to lead you right through that whole notion of success and confidence. They're going to work on one another. So forget that. Work on improvement. And that's all we're trying to do, and everything else flows from that. So I didn't mean to diverge into that, but that's something we talk about with our kids all the time. It's just simply about the improvement aspect of things.
Well, the most powerful word in learning is yet, right? And I love that, how that you brought that in. And then the other part, the way I phrase it, is to notice progress. I mean, that's the most important part, as you said, this improvement is this process that they all go through. And that's part of the learning progress. And noticing that progress keeps them on task, but also keeps them motivated because they know that
question.
They're
improving. And sometimes there's a misinterpretation of that. So when we're teaching kids to finish, the whole idea is you want to start on balance, end on balance, and in between you can figure out your own dribbles. But we're trying to get there as quickly as we can on balance. And so you've got to play as fast as you can. So if I told you get on the baseline, we're going to work on handling. The first thing that comes into play is handling. And I don't care if you turn it over. I want you to pound the ball as hard as you can, make moves, left hand, right hand, whatever, give them some combinations. Don't care if you throw it away, because you're trying to catch it and then get your hand. It's an interesting thing. You're trying to flip from one hand to the next. Your hand can't be on top of either because you're pushing it from one to the next, so your palms kind of are in. But once you catch it, you now have to move your hands and get your hands on top and pound the ball to the ground as quickly as you possibly can. So when a kid turns it over, when the ball rolls up his hand, we say that's progress, because now he's playing at the speed we want him to. When a kid drives in as hard as he can, and at least in this possession, and he hits it off the backboard and the ball ricochets out to midcourt, I stop and say, what is that? And the kids know the response. That's progress, because this guy's playing as fast as he can, and now he's not going to speed up in the game, which is the worst thing that can happen to you, right? Try and speed up in the game and do things you haven't done at that speed. And so that's another way of identifying progress. So just to supplement what you're saying.
Yeah, that's great. I've always wondered, is there an ideal length of possession for the Princeton offense? Like, everyone's perception it used to be more hold the ball and work the clock probably to get the best opportunity. But is that gone now? Is it just whenever the opportunity is there and you have an advantage, you're taking advantage of advantage?
Yeah, I think we want a shot on our terms, a shot that we want. And if we're shooting a shot on our terms, we're comfortable with that. You know, and this might be just a little of a cautionary tale. No one's asked me to expound on this to other coaches. But I'm concerned a little bit with the shot clock going at 30 and, you know, all of a sudden you subdivide it into the three 10-second segments, okay? And so you got the ball at the floor and the first, that's your early break, your transition or whatever, maybe, you know, and then you don't have it. Now you go to the middle 10 seconds and then you're down at the end of it, I don't know, ball screen, whatever. Well, you really haven't maybe worked and moved the defense that much in that 10-second segment. So it was just so interesting to me years ago. That's all of a sudden you're running Princeton and you might be running chin, just for example, and you might turn it over four times. You know, I don't mean turn it over, lose it. I mean, turn over the chin, you know, movement four times and then and before something eventuates. So it's the idea of, I think that, you know, it's having too much of that kind of stuff. You know, you're getting away probably from what you do best because you're trying to do too much and you're trying to do it in a short period of time. We talk about this all the time with Doug. You want to move the ball down, up and over. And you want to go side, side, down, which is the opposite of that. So if you can move the ball across the midline and above and below the free throw line, well, now you've moved all the defenders. So it takes time to be able to do that and then exploit the defense against teams who are coached, who know how to move defensively.
What concepts are you teaching first as you marry those two offenses concepts together? What are you teaching first? And I guess
The identical action would be if I'm on the left guard to guard, you're on the right guard to guard, and you have in a dribble drive, you've got someone in the corner. So let me just name this for you. This is another way of just giving something. So our post player, we just call him P. So you and I are in the same lateral position, right? We're horizontal, right? You're in the right guard to guard. I'm on the left. We're called twins. If I have someone longitudinally, someone in the corner below me and I'm above them, we call them mates. So the guys in the corners are twins because they're in the same lateral position. So this identifies where we should be on the court. But let's say you throw the ball to me, okay, and you can cut to either corner, but we're going to send you on a zip cut. I'm on the left guard to guard. You're going to cut to the left corner. That's going to push the guy up to the left corner. So now I'm going to try and drive it downhill, but I've got to cross where the space would be, let's just say, where there are less defenders. So I cross the nail hole, and I go to the right driveway, which is the right junction area. So that's dribble drive. I got a guy in the corner, but he may be lifting a little bit. We could talk about that later technically if you want. But here's what I got. I've got two people on the backside, and I got a post down low. So I can play with out with the person in the corner. I can play down with the post player right there. I can play back with the guy at the top behind me, and I can play over, skip the ball with the guy there. This is the exact same action where if you went to some kind of back cut action and P came and set that screen, remember that retrograde screen where the defenders jump to the ball and he's penalized himself, and you catch the ball there? Do you remember that?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, well, so now what happens on the catch, it winds up being the exact same action. I'm trying to drive the ball. Let's say I don't shoot it. I lift up, I look over the ball, and I drive the ball. I mean, I may be open because you're trying to get the defender to arc around that screen. But what happens, it doesn't matter because here's what you got. You have one person in the corner who is outside of you. You have the post player, P, now who's rolled down to be down. You have two on the backside. So that action, even though it's two different systems, is identical. And so we're trying to identify situations in there where we can, you know, turn these situations into identical situations that cuts the teaching time in half. So there's a couple of those, but that's just one which I think, you know, you have obviously an understanding of this, how those two can happen.
Yeah, no, I mean, what you're saying applies to so many things that we could do. If we can find an efficiency in teaching and obviously maximize the outcome, then it makes sense. So this is fascinating. Yeah, it's truly fascinating. And have you found in your years coaching the Princeton offense, have you found anything to be truly effective that gave it problems defensively, approaching it from that other perspective?
No. I mean, I think, again, I think the defensive physicality, we went through a time too. I think they cleaned up the game somewhere, you know, where people were definitely holding and shoving and knocking you off of cuts and things of that nature. And they've tried to, you know, clean that up somewhat. I think just the general physical play of the defense could throw you off gear, particularly if you couldn't get through the friction with the dribble or if you couldn't extricate yourself with a bounce successfully. We were never worried about being scouted where somebody would know what we're going to run because the offense, it's like a thread that continues to ravel. You know, again, back to the concepts, you know, we were into ABC. What's the action beyond the concept? What's the sub act? It can go from here, there. And if I don't like anything, we like to play in flow. We could pull the ball out to that guard to guard and we can make a call. We can make a verbal and a visual if we needed to. We could change the action. And so that's one of the interesting things about the dribble drive is, you know, when we pull it out to the guard to guard, you know, our default action is to stay in dribble drive. But I could easily change to Princeton, let's just say before I pulled it out by just saying set, S-E-T, say that three times and pull the ball out. And that tells everyone now we're looking to get into Princeton and we have three separate entries we can use to get into that. That's just an example. So the idea of going from one to the other, I think, and the multiplicity and the diversification is successful. I don't know that, you know, I would ever coach anywhere again where I wasn't going to try and do both of those because I think you can effectively combine the two. And I think you have a large payoff when you do.
Is there an ideal team for this, or can this offensive concept you're discussing here, can this be run by any team? Can any high school team develop this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've spoken to, in the last 6 months to a year, I've talked to 10 different high school teams about this stuff. Like I say, it seems to be trending for some reason, combining the two. No, I think it can be done, but I just think you can make some adjustments. Like you can take with our post player 2 years ago, was a kid who was 5'9". We just put him below the defense when we drove the ball. He's facing the ball, and he caught it, and he shot a mic and layup while he was facing midcourt. He just bounced it, you know, shot it off the glass. You have some kids when we call it escaping, when you drive the ball at a guy and he loops out, and we used to loop this kid out in the post, and you know, he'd be behind the ball. He could shoot, he could make threes. Other times we didn't have guys who can do that. So you've just got to make some tweaks, adjusting it to your personnel, but you know, that's what coaching's about, and you figure those things out, and the kids will figure those things out. That's really one of the things I miss the most at this is the preparation, the mental preparation, evaluating what I call it, you know, one of the obligations of leadership. Accurately interpret reality. You've got to accurately interpret reality as it relates to your enterprise and your environment, wherever you are in the world of work or whatever you're doing. And that can be shifting. Some of it can be constant, but it can be shifting all the time. So this is Aristotle's notion of phronesis, and the idea of paying attention, being aware, and making good decisions based upon what's accurate. And so I miss that, looking at a team and trying to figure out what's the best way to put us in a situation for success, and then coaching the kids into that system and then seeing them develop and hopefully having some success. So that's something that I'm happy doing the teaching. I'm not as fulfilled now because I'm not hand-to-hand with kids every day working on these things together.
Okay, Coach, let's go back to the basics here. How are we going to teach?
Okay. So I'm gonna talk about two active forces that we have. This is going to be a little philosophical, so hopefully you can bear with me, and hopefully you can see how this resonates and how relevant it is. So the first thing I talk about is in each one of these forces, all right, they need to be directed, and then they need to be fused together to be effective if we're going to move to success and then beyond that to mastery. The first one is we need precision with accuracy. So this, and you can look at this even as two parts of the brain, but I'm looking at it as active forces. So the first notion of precision is to be detailed, is to be intricate, is to be oriented to as I said, the detail of things. But precision and detail, all right, is not the same as accuracy. Let's say we were shooting at arrows at a target, and we clustered about five of the arrows right together, all within about an inch from everything, from each other. But they didn't hit the target. They're outside of where they're supposed to be. So, or if you have a clock, which, say, unrelentingly ticks every second, constantly, consistently, and there obviously is consistency there, but you might have the wrong time. So precision married with accuracy. You've got to have the accuracy there in the detail. The other part to combine with this is rigor with clarity. So you need just the energy part of it, but it can't be just energy to have energy. What you're looking for, an economy of motion. You're using your energy like a laser. If you had a laser pointed, you're focusing all your energy where it needs to be. Okay. So what you've got to do, going back to these two, if you had one without the other, if you had detail without any rigor, then it would be anemic. It would be weak. And if you had rigor without detail or precision, then it would be dangerous because you wouldn't have any technique. You wouldn't have any organization. These things would not be directed. So you're working at, like in Ghostbusters, you know, crossing the screens. You're trying to actively fuse these two things together. And these are dynamic and active forces. They have to be put together by you mentally and then physically to manifest themselves. And there's nothing static about it. You just don't lay two things together. They have to constantly be monitored for you to marry the two, to be effective, to be masterful in what you do. So hopefully that's not so esoteric that got lost.
It is a little bit. But people who listen to that will get it. And I would not want you to be any other way, Coach. This is the whole point of this podcast, is to share depth of teaching, to share depth of thinking, to share depth of knowledge, obviously, so that people can stimulate their thinking and think differently. And that's, I can't imagine you doing it any other way.
And there's a form of coaching this. So when I look at kids, instead of trying to engage in detail and precision with accuracy, they're working on approximation. I say, no, that's not it. That's not it. Your technique is off. And then when I look at kids and they're substituting gesture for rigor, all right, then I say, that's not good enough. So you coach this two different ways based upon the failure of one of your mentor, I mean, one of your students or players to be able to execute one or the other. So there's a going back to language, there's a way to coach this, and you just have, you know, you have to observe. We're not going to substitute approximation. We're not going to substitute gesture. We've got to combine the rigor with the precision, the detail, et cetera, with the accuracy. That's got to work for us. If we can't work for us, then we're recreating, basically.
Coach, I cannot thank you enough. Tell us a little bit. You're doing some consulting now, and we're going to help spread the word for that. You're interested in working with any teams, and anyone that's interested in learning more about these concepts, we're going to help spread the word as well. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, what I've done this really for 40 years, you know, coaching, 45 years actually. And I really never charged for this. And in fact, while I was even working at high school here at Newman, I was actually working with some other kids and some other teams, and a couple of which we actually played against them. And the point being in this, I want to see kids get better. I want to share as many ideas. I'm at the end, you know, I'm going to be 70 years old in a number of months. And I want to help as many people as I can who want to be helped. You know, it's interesting because some people say they want to learn about the Princeton offense, and you get into the intricacy of this and their eyes glaze over and that they really don't want to learn this, you know. But a lot of people are obviously well-intentioned and want to learn the details of things. That's how we get to the success of that. You don't have to be detailed just for detail's sake. It's, you know, it's the Einstein notion. Make things as simple as possible, but not simpler. So we have to be as nuanced as we can to be successful. But anyway, so my point is, I've had a lot of, you know, in the last year since I've announced my retirement, a lot of people who called me and I said, listen, I want to do this, but I'm not using this to retire on the French Riviera, but I want to be compensated for this. So I've set up a compensatory scale, and I've had a number of people who were interested in calling me, and you know, I'm looking to expand that some while I'm still enjoying my teaching at this point, and just we're going to see where that goes.
Well, I wish you all the luck, and I'll certainly help spread the word. And thank you so much for taking the time and just sharing the game with us, Coach.
It was my pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.